So we're going to just start by looking at the story so far, and then Molly's going to come and read the first part. So if you remember the book of Esther, it's set in the Persian Empire and the city of Susa. The action takes place around about sort of 480 to 470 before Christ. And it's a time when the Persian Empire was dominant. They'd defeated the Babylonians, but they were themselves under threat from Greece. And King Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, was the ruler of a massive kingdom that actually stretched from India one side right over to North Africa. So you can see what a huge area was under his rule. 127 different provinces. And you remember that he was pretty well ruler of all that he surveys, except his wife Vashti, who disobeyed him by refusing to appear at a massive banquet that he'd set up to bring in all the princes and the rulers to, one of the reasons being to try and put an army together to fight against the Greeks. Xerxes was not amused, I have to say, at Vashti's disobedience, and an edict was sent out to the whole kingdom that two things. First of all, that Vashti would never again be allowed to enter the king's presence, and secondly, that all women must respect their husbands. Remember how great that would go down well, wouldn't it? So a replacement queen was required, and a process was put in place to allow the king to choose from all the most beautiful, choicest virgins from across the whole of his kingdom. And you remember that a young girl called Esther was chosen as the new queen. She'd found favour with those that had been in charge of the sort of harem, not only because of her beauty, but of course also because of her nature. She was beautiful inside and outside, if you like. Unknown to the king, though, Esther was a Jew. She'd been orphaned when she was young. She'd been brought up by an older relative, a cousin called Mordecai, who she clearly greatly respected. She obeyed him. And when Mordecai warned her to keep her Jewish ancestry quiet, she did just that. And you remember in the whole of the story last week, there was no mention of God, no mention of prayer or religion. We're left to discern God's hidden influence in the story. And we'll see this evening very much the same thing. So perhaps, Molly, if you'd like to come up and read, we're going to read the last few verses of chapter 2 of Esther.
Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, but Esther had kept secret her family background and nationality, just sitting at the king's gate. Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's officers who guarded the doorway, became angry and conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. But Mordecai found out about the plot and told Queen Esther, who in turn reported it to the king, giving credit to Mordecai. And when the report was investigated and found to be true, the two officials were hanged on a gallows. All this was recorded in the book of the annals in the presence of the king.
So this week, and certainly in this first part, in fact both parts really, Mordecai becomes the central character really in the story. And we meet him at the beginning. He's sitting at the king's gate of the city, which was more than just a gateway. It wasn't just a gateway. It was actually the place where the city elders would actually meet together. It's the place where they would discuss business. They would probably discuss laws and processes and that sort of thing. It was a place of commerce. There was perhaps a market there. And the very fact that Mordecai was there shows that he actually was a person of some sort of influence. It wasn't just anybody that would be able to sit at the king's gate. We don't know what his position was. It may be that he was some sort of civil servant, perhaps. We don't know. And actually, in this particular part of the passage, there's no mention really of Mordecai's Jewishness either. All that we do know is that Esther was continuing to be obedient to Mordecai by keeping that secret that Mordecai was Jewish and that she was related to him and that she was a Jew. Now, while he's in that position of some authority, maybe, at the gate, Mordecai actually overhears two of the king's officers of the guard, and they're angry. We don't know what they're angry about, but they're so angry that their plot is to kill King Xerxes. So we don't really know what their grievance was, but it was obviously a real threat. And in fact, if you read on a bit, or if you look at the life of King Xerxes, he was actually assassinated by somebody close to him. His prime minister, no less. Couldn't get much closer. So it clearly was a plot to kill the king, and Mordecai tells Esther about it. And Esther tells the king. And she gives the credit to Mordecai for having found this information. And it tells us that the plot is investigated and it's found to be true. And the perpetrators, Bigthana and Teresh, are put to death. It says they're hung. And it tells us that all of the details are recorded in the book of the annals, a record of all the significant events in the king's reign. Which seems to be quite almost an irrelevant piece of information, isn't it? But a bit of a spoiler alert. Remember it. It might come up later. So all the details were written down in the book of the annals about this plot, Mordecai's position in it, and so on. So what can we learn from this episode? In some ways it's quite difficult for us to learn. When there's no actually specific mention of God, there's obviously no specific teaching that we can actually hang on to. And it's such a brief snippet that it seems to have very little relevance. But remember that God is at work. So this apparent coincidence will become relevant later. It does, however, tell us a little bit about Esther. Because she's still in contact with and has respect for her relative Mordecai. She clearly believes what he says because telling Xerxes about a plot against him was actually quite a dangerous thing for her to do, wasn't it? If the plot had been turned out to be untrue, what would the consequences have been for her? Probably not good. And funnily enough, that's actually the only mention we get of Esther in the whole of this evening. So she doesn't appear in the next episode. So it tells us a little about Esther, a little bit about Esther, that she's still very much in touch with Mordecai. She's still being obedient to him, really. What does it tell us about Mordecai? Well, it tells us that he must have been a person of influence and position. Merely to have been there, he must have been in that position because he was sitting in the king's gate, or at the king's gate. And in that position, he hears a plot that threatens the king. So what is he to do? Well, remember that he's a Jew. He's in exile, in a foreign land, a pagan land. The Jewish nation's been scattered and taken into exile by the Babylonians. And they're now under the Persian rule. And although the conditions have been eased a bit and some of the Jews are allowed to go back into Jerusalem to rebuild the temple, it was still a bit of a perilous time, wasn't it? And so, yes, they were in a foreign land, a pagan land, and here he hears about a plot to kill this pagan ruler, for which he probably, he's not too happy with him. But Mordecai had stayed in the foreign land. He hadn't been one of the ones that had gone to rebuild the temple. So he had a choice. He could have kept quiet and let the plot sort of progress. Maybe it would have led to the death of the king that he probably wasn't happy about anyway. But no, he decided to expose the plot by telling Esther, who then told the king. And as I said before, it could have been a risky strategy, but that could really have backfired, particularly on him and on Esther too, if the plot had turned out not to be true. But of course it didn't, because God was in control. So what was Esther's reason for, or sorry, Mordecai's reason for exposing the plot? Well, there's been some speculation about this. Could it have been for recognition or advancement? Well, that would have been for selfish reasons, really, wouldn't it? And there isn't any evidence that that was the reason. And there's nothing really to tell us that at this stage his contribution was even recognised. I have put in brackets yet. You'll have to come back in future weeks to see whether it is or not. So what was he showing? He was showing loyalty to the king, wasn't he? He was showing a sense of duty, even though who he was. And it may be surprising, given what we've said about the Jews being in exile under the power of a pagan king. But actually it's a principle that's laid down for us in the New Testament. If you look in the first letter of Peter, it says there, fear God, honour the king. Submitting to authorities. If I just read a few verses from 1 Peter 2, verses 13 to 17, under the heading Submission to Rulers and Masters. Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every authority instituted among men, whether to the king as the supreme authority, or to governors who are sent by him to punish those who do wrong and to commend those who do right. For it is God's will that by doing good you should silence the ignorant talk of foolish men. Live as free men, but do not use your freedom as a cover-up for evil. Live as servants of God. Show proper respect to everyone. Love the brotherhood of believers. Fear God. Honour the king. And really that's what Mordecai was doing. He was being... His sense of duty, he was being loyal to the king. And where do these authorities come from? In Romans 13, everyone must submit himself to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God. Consequently, he who rebels against the authority is rebelling against what God has instituted, and those who do so will bring judgment on themselves. See, we heard very similar verses this morning, didn't we, when Martin was talking about the church in Thyatira. So submitting to authorities actually isn't that unusual, and it's actually something that we as Christians should do, because we should be model citizens, submitting to the rule of law, paying our taxes. It actually goes on to talk about that in Romans 13 as well. Showing proper respect to everyone. Loving our neighbour. Because as we know, all human life is to be respected. Because we're all made in God's image. It doesn't mean we should be sort of meek and mild, timid creatures who just sort of go along with what society is doing and what we're told. No, we have the right and the opportunity, really, to stand up against wrongdoing and injustice, to stand up against misuse of power and repression, to stand for freedom and peace and mutual respect and justice. But we should be respecting those in authority. So what would we have done if we were in Mordecai's shoes? And we'll come back to the next phase of the story in a few moments. So chapter 3.
After these events, King Xerxes honoured Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, elevating him and giving him a seat of honour higher than that of all the nobles. All the royal officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid honour to Haman, for the king had commanded this concerning him. But Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honour, Then the royal officials at the king's gate asked Mordecai, "Why do you disobey the king's command?" Day after day they spoke to him, but he refused to comply. Therefore they told Haman about it to see whether Mordecai's behaviour would be tolerated, for he had told them that he was a Jew. When Haman saw that Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honour, he was enraged. Yet having learned who Mordecai's people were, he scorned the idea of killing only Mordecai. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes. In the 12th year of King Xerxes, in the first month, the month of Nisan, they cast the pur, that is, the lot, in the presence of Haman to select a day and a month. And the lot fell on the 12th month, the month of Adar. Then Haman said to King Xerxes, "There is a certain people dispersed and scattered among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom, whose customs are different from those of all other people, and who do not obey the king's laws. It is not in the king's best interest to tolerate them. If it pleases the king, let a decree be issued to destroy them, and I will put 10,000 talents of silver into the royal treasury for the men who carry out this business." So the king took his signet ring from his finger and gave it to Haman, son of Hammedatha the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. "Keep the money," the king said to Haman, "and do with the people as you please." Then on the 13th day of the first month, the royal secretaries were summoned. They wrote out in the script of each province and in the language of each people all Haman's orders to the king's satraps, the governors of various provinces, and the nobles of the various people. These were written in the name of King Xerxes himself and sealed with his own ring. Dispatches were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with the order to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews, young and old, women and little children, on a single day, the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. A copy of the text of the edict was to be issued as law in every province and made known to the people of every nationality so that they would be ready for that day. Spurred on by the king's command, the couriers went out and the edict was issued in the citadel of Susa. The king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa was bewildered.
So we have another episode that doesn't seem to bear an awful lot of relationship to the previous ones either, does it? And as we said before, I said earlier on, Esther doesn't even get a mention in chapter 3. But we do meet the other key player in the story, a man called Haman, son of Hammedatha. And for some unstated reason, we don't know what, he has gained a promotion. Massive promotion, in fact, right up to the highest of the ranks. Effectively, he's become the king's right-hand man. And he's given a seat of honour, higher than all the other nobles. And at the king's command, all must bow down to him and give him the honour that his rank deserves. And as we'll see, this man is pure evil. But it does appear, though, that all the officials at the king's gate did kneel down and bow in Haman's presence, gave him the honour that supposedly he deserves, with one exception, our friend Mordecai. And day after day, the other officials asked him why it is he's refusing to comply. But actually, he doesn't give them a reason. Again, commentators have speculated on Mordecai's reasons for his disobedience to the king's command. Because again, it was a dangerous thing for him to do, to stand out in that way. And the only clue we get in the text is Mordecai's admission that he is a Jew. Well, so why is that relevant? Well, if we go back to verse 1, it describes Haman as son of Hammedatha the Agagite. So this links the book, or links him back through his family tree to King Agag, who was king of the Amalekites, who you may remember were sworn enemies of the Israelites. If we go back further generations, we'll see that. Back in Exodus, if you remember that the Israelites had sort of escaped from Egypt, they crossed the Red Sea, and they were travelling on their way to Mount Sinai, which is where they would receive the law and the Ten Commandments. And while they were on that journey between the Red Sea and Mount Sinai, they were attacked by the Amalekites. And although they were given the victory, in Exodus 17:15 it says that the Lord will be at war with the Amalekites from generation to generation. So setting the scene there, these are going to be the sworn enemies of the Israelites, and it's going to come out in future generations. And actually, if you trace even further back, you'll find that Amalek was actually a descendant of Esau. You remember Jacob and Esau? Esau was the older brother from whom Jacob stole his birthright. So the conflict, if you like, goes right the way back to Jacob and Esau, and it was then going to be renewed right through the generations between their descendants, the Israelites and the Amalekites. And now we see it being replayed again between Mordecai and Haman. So that probably is the most likely reason why Mordecai refused to bow, because he was a sworn enemy of this man who had been put into this position. So in a similar way to King Xerxes and Vashti that we saw in the first chapter, one of the people in authority is being disrespected, and we await Haman's response when he hears of this disobedience. Well, as in the first chapter, his response is not good. He's very angry. And when he hears that Mordecai is a Jew, a sworn enemy of his people, he concocts a plan. Not only a plan to get rid of Mordecai, but actually to get rid of the whole of the Jewish nation. All the Jews in the kingdom would be killed on a specific day. A final solution? Does that ring any bells? But how to put that plan into action? Because actually, although he was a powerful man, Haman, he didn't have the ultimate authority. He needed to get the king on his side. He needed to play on his newfound influence with the king. And that's what we are going to see. Last week, we were making a little bit of fun about the king, in that we were saying he perhaps wasn't the sharpest tool in the tool shed, or the fastest runner in the race. And Haman comes up with a proposition for him. If I read verses 8 and 9, then Haman said to the king Xerxes, "There's a certain people dispersed and scattered among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom, whose customs are different from those of all other people, and who do not obey the king's laws. It's not in the king's best interest to tolerate them. If it pleases the king, let a decree be issued to destroy them. And I'll put 10,000 talents of silver into the royal treasury for the men who carry out this business." Not an awful lot of information given to the king there, was there? There was a hefty bribe of a lot of money to be given, but not an awful lot of information. So you might think that the king would ask one or two questions, like, well, how many people are we talking about? Because all it says really is that there's a certain people dispersed amongst you. So is it half a dozen? We don't know. Is it a few activists? And then perhaps he could have asked, well, who are they? Are they some sort of particular race? Are they a particular religion? Maybe they're a sect? Who are they? And then he could have asked, well, exactly what is it that they've done? Doesn't give anything there, really, does it? It says that they've got different practices, They don't obey the king's laws. Well, in what way do they not obey the king's laws? So he could have asked some very simple questions. But no. King Xerxes must have trusted his second in command. So, casually, he gives him his signet ring. You know, the ring that is needed for signing of any official documents. He hands over his ring to Haman and says, basically, no matter what it is, you got on with it. No problem. Don't worry about the cost. And, well, let's go and celebrate. Let's have a drink. And before issuing the orders, Haman casts lots to decide on the timing of the mass destruction of all the Jews. Something that was actually common practice at the time. And it gives a chance for perhaps any gods to intervene in the decision. And lo and behold, God himself intervenes, if you like, because when they cast the lot comes up for, although they're in the first month of the year, the lot comes up for the very last month of the year, giving the people, the Jewish, Israelite people, the maximum of time to prepare for what's to come. So that's the story, and well, what can we learn from that episode? Again, it's not very easy, is it? There's no mention of God, or no explicit teaching. In fact, there's not even a mention of our heroine, Esther. These seemingly random events, which may or may not be seen to be relevant as the story unfolds. Well, is God at work when the lot is cast? You would say so, because it was clearly in favour of the Jews, delaying their destruction. But what of the final solution from Haman? And the fact that it was apparently based on the disobedience and lack of respect of just the one man. Clearly we can't say that's, well, we would say that's not fair. Why should the action of one man have such profound effects for a whole nation? But actually that leads us to the cross, where the actions of one man, Jesus, God's Son, has such profound effect on our relationship with God. Is it fair that Jesus should take the punishment for all our sin? Well, no, it isn't really, is it? But it's a price that God was prepared to pay to bring us into fellowship with him. To bring us into fellowship free from baggage, free from guilt, free from our sin, free to worship him. So I'm sure that's one of the things we can bring from it. What about the other lesson we could perhaps learn about the way that Haman achieved his end by getting the king to comply with his request? He only gave part of the story, didn't he? He only gave the king some of the information that perhaps the king wanted to hear. And the king wasn't quick-witted enough or even interested enough to see that he was in fact being duped. So are there any lessons for us in our society today? Do we make off-the-cuff decisions? Or do we root out all of the facts first? Have we made casual decisions that have had big consequences? Are we always told the whole truth? Think on.